You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Well, now, Dick, you mentioned earlier that Brian Cannon was coming in. I said, don't mention the guest until they turn up, because we did that once before and they didn't turn up for, I think they got lost or they got the wrong day.
They got the wrong day, but I knew Brian and thought he'll be here.
I can mention Brian now. Brian Cannon has arrived and his wife, Raquel.
Correct.
Not Rachel. Rachel or Raquel?
Raquel.
Raquel.
As in Raquel Welsh.
That's right.
Yes. Ah, it's easy to remember. How obvious, Dick. I knew you were going to say that. Do you know anyone else that's called Raquel beside Raquel Welsh?
Gee, I don't
know. No, that's right.
Apart from
that was usually followed with that when Raquel would introduce herself.
That's, of course, people say, oh, after Raquel Welsh. It's like,
but then as people got sort of under 50, you'd say as in Welsh, they go, oh, you're Welsh, are you?
Yeah, that's right, the under 50. I met someone the other day.
So why are you called Brian? Was there an original Brian, you know?
Just the original, mate.
The life of.
That's right.
Is in the life of Brian. That's
right. I met a woman the other day called Ava. And, of course, I don't know if you remember Ava Gardner. No one else. So I've never heard anyone other than that person. Oh, you're named after Ava Gardner. So I actually was, yes. Yeah, my parents loved Ava.
I love old movies, so.
But we digress, Brian. So welcome to You Cannot Be Serious. Now, we've just did this on the last segment, but Pseudo Echo. I know you formed the band in 1984.
82. But 84 is the anniversary.
I've got that written down here and I still didn't read it properly. Right. 1982 with Pierre Gigliotti.
Pierre Gigliotti, yeah.
Gigliotti. You were high school buddies.
Yeah.
And I want to know where you got the name Pseudo Echo. It's an interesting name. Yeah. We've mentioned what pseudo means. We've mentioned what echo means. Where did you come up with that?
Well, when we started Pseudo Echo, because prior to Pseudo Echo, we were just your standard garage band with a couple of guitars and drum kits and things like that. Mm-hmm. When we made the change and we started becoming an electronic band. And
so when was that? When did that happen
exactly? It was sort of about, well, the start of it was kind of close to 80, 81. And then by the time we got the configuration of Pseudo Echo, it was 82.
Yep.
And that's when we started investing in a whole bunch of electronic gear, keyboards and electronic drum machines and things like that. Back in those days, the synths were pretty basic. They didn't have, like now, you just push a button and you've got this sound and that sound. You had to make the sound.
Yep.
You had to be a computer nerd and read the manual and learn all the controls.
And you did a lot.
I've seen an old synthesizer. I'm a wizard synth.
Yeah.
If I say so myself. And so, one of the synthesizers we had, which is an iconic synthesizer called an Arp Odyssey, used by many famous bands, the manual had all these sort of examples of sounds with a diagram of where to put the dials for each sound. As we were talking about band names, our fellow keyboard player, Tony Lugton, was perusing through his manual. And we said, so what are we going to call ourselves? And he was just up to page 59 or whatever it was, and it said Pseudo Echo Machine. And he said, how about Pseudo Echo? He may have even said it wrong, pronounced it wrong. But we sort of heard it. We said, that sounds good. And, you know, being the 80s, it was all about
technology.
Technology and echo machines.
Yep.
So it sounded right.
So it came from the catalogue of an ARP.
That's right. It was the sound.
Synthesizer.
There you go. Well, now that it's explained, Brian, it sounds very logical that you would call it that. So I'm tempted to say, so you deliberately did this style of music, unlike Vili Manilli, who tried to get away with pretending that that person tried to get away with pretending that she was she?
No,
Milli Vanilli were two people that they were lip syncing.
That's right.
Yeah, and they weren't actually even singing on their own
records.
But you never did anything like that. You actually performed.
We were real pioneers.
And you were part, in a sense, you were part of the movement of that period that I guess could be called new wave or new romantic, even. Like bands like Ultravox, Depeche Mode overseas, and you were almost the Australian vanguard.
Yeah,
like, could you say that?
Absolutely. Like for us, it was tough competition. There was a garage band on every corner, and they were all just standard sort of 70s rock sound, as we were. So when we made that move, and I started to hear these new bands overseas, and I knew that it was keyboards that we needed. It was an electronic sound that they were all having that was making this new wave. And so that's why we invested in all that gear. And we just basically, even the songs we had in our set then, we just converted them to electronic songs.
Yes, yes.
You know, where there would be a guitar riff, we just make that a synthesizer
riff. A synth riff,
Where there was a bass part on guitar, we played on a bass keyboard.
And the Aussies are kind of used to kind of pub rock in the late 70s. Right. How did they take to a band using mainly synthesizers in 1981?
In the early days, it was a bit courageous because we didn't even have a drummer. We just had a drum machine. Because the drum machine sounded fantastic.
Was that Echo?
That's right. It sounded fantastic. It sounded like, when your drums are produced on an album.
Yeah.
Whereas when you hear a drum kit raw, they're pretty crap sounding. Mm-hmm. They're rattly and shitty and it's not a great groove. Unless you've got a great sound guy, the drums will sound pretty average.
Yep.
But with a drum machine, as soon as you plugged it in, it sounded epic.
Yeah, and obviously drum machines have become a huge part of popular music. Obviously rap music drum machines that's a huge part of rap music.
On the downside, having a drum machine, you've got nobody on stage with the energy.
Yep.
It's just completely sterile on stage.
Yep. So how did you do it?
And so we did that for about maybe 6 months, braved it. Icebox chucked at us and things hurled at us all the time. And luckily we had pretty catchy songs and so eventually through the gig they go, these guys are all right.
Yep. But
it was a bit scary, because to see just a couple of guys, one guy with a guitar singing and two keyboards.
Yep.
It was like, what the fuck's that?
Were there many other synthesizer bands around at the time? No,
there were really none.
So you were almost it.
It was a handful. Real Life were giving it a go, but most of them were more traditional.
Ollie Olsen, did you ever hear his stuff? Ollie Olsen?
Yep. So about 6 months in, we got wind of some more technology, which was electronic drums.
Yep.
Like a drum kit.
But you actually had a drummer in the early days.
Yeah, well, this is when we got him.
Yep.
Really, like we did about 6 months of gigging without, and then bang, we bought ourselves an electronic drum kit. Now, we had to call up a music shop in the UK in the middle of the night, because we'd seen the ad in the catalogue. Yeah, and there's no internet or it's old school. Yeah. And on the phone.
Are they those Sin drums?
Yeah, Simmons. They were like hexagonal shape, plastic, and they had a brain which had all the electronic sounds.
And who was your drummer?
And it was Anthony Aguirre. We recruited him on drums and said, "Get rid of your old kit. We're putting this thing on." So I can remember the first gig was in Melbourne. We had it under a veil.
Yep.
And the crowd was there to see us as usual, expecting to see the three pieces.
Yep.
And all of a sudden there's this drum kit, and when they took the veil off, the crowd started cheering.
Yep.
Because they'd never seen anything like it. It's like, what the hell? It looked like a spaceship.
Yep.
So this is
a full synth band.
The start of us having a live drummer.
There it is.
So someone said that you were a fashionable, coiffured young synth pop band when you had a makeover, I think, after you reformed.
That's fantastic.
I've just been listening to this. You are absolutely the epitome of being innovative, because you left high school with your friend Pierre Gigliotti to start out doing this, and you said there was a garage band on every corner, mate, and to stand out, you've had to do something.
That's right.
You've had to be unique, people would underestimate that about Pseudo Echo and you, because to stand out and do what you've done is that is innovation in the extreme. So I hope people appreciate that, Brian. That's right. Extraordinary.
No, I agree. And there's been many electronic bands that have followed, in a sense, in your footsteps. So, like, obviously now it's not uncommon for there to be electronic music bands.
Now it's kind of the norm.
Exactly.
Presets
and...
That's right.
Many other Australian bands.
It's become a very unique decade, the 80s, of that sound, and now it's, back with a vengeance.
Of course,
So I just watched the... on Netflix, I think it was, how... Spotify started. It's called The Playlist.
Yeah.
And so those couple of blokes got together and thought... Mm. So you got together with someone at high school, Pierre.
Yeah.
And how did you decide that this was the way to go? Were you in music? Did you have a musical bent before that, or did you thought we'll try and do something when we leave high school? Why don't we have a crack at this?
Well, my dad was a muso. He was a jazz musician, played trumpet, trombone, sax, bass, bit of piano. He was just a sort of a hobby player. He played in his Air Force band.
So you
back in the day.
Grew up in a musical household.
So there was a bit of music around, but my brothers were all football players and great football players. They had lots of trophies, and I was terrible at football. I always wanted to be a football star because, you know, my brothers were all stars. Yeah. And you know, my oldest brother played with Collingwood for a while.
Did you play in high school then?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I did. But, I was a pipsqueak. I was so little. They'd put me as a rover or whatever. Or a wing or chuck me somewhere. And all I'd do is, you know, I was okay at getting the ball, but I was just a terrible kick.
Yeah.
And I've honed that, by the way, since. I'm pretty good now.
That's what we worked on his game.
But so the sport thing wasn't for me. And I was just natural I was always drawn to a piano or a guitar, or I'd know every kid in the neighbourhood who had a guitar and an amp, and I'd be pestering them, can I have a turn of it? And every band, like I said, there was a garage band on every corner. So for me, it was bliss, you know, head out with my posse on our dragsters, turn up to the garage and just watch some band, you know, playing, you know, 70s rock covers.
So that I was going to ask you, so you wrote the songs that you
sing? I wrote the majority of the songs, yeah, because...
none of them are covers?
Well, Funky Town, our swan song. It's
one of your biggest hits.
That was a cover from...
The original Funky Town?
79.
Lip Sync,
yep, they were called. They just had that one song, and I heard Molly play that song at a club in about 1980.
Yep.
It was released a year before overseas. Yep. Then about 1980 it was released in Australia. And I heard
he was a DJ, was he?
He was DJing. And I remember like making a mental note of that song.
Yeah.
That's a corker. Yep. You know, the bass part of it and the white noise. And all, just it was something about it. Very simple, but I loved it. And I just kept that in my back pocket for the next 5 years.
And you had international success with that song.
Yeah, killed it with that song.
Mm-hmm. And you would have to pay royalties to the people? Well, how does that work?
Steve Greenberg, the writer, he'd take in a writer share, but we also take in a share as with the artist and the performer. So it's good all around. Mm. Everybody's happy.
And you appeared many times on Countdown?
Many times.
Now, Molly Meldrum was sort of influential in your early career. Yeah. Like, he was an early supporter of the band, is that correct?
Well, you know, you got to remember, I used to go to his club when he was DJing.
What was his club?
It was the Croc.
The Croc.
In the northern suburbs. And you know, when he first got a tip-off about this new band, that he was told to come and check out this new band, he had no idea I was in it.
Yep.
So when he comes along and he starts, he's looking at us and he's, you know, the gig was packed that night.
Yep.
We had a great crowd. And, you know, Molly's there freaking out. He's going, I know this little kid. Mm. He's the kid who sits on the sidelines and, you know, listens to my music every Thursday night.
Yep.
And so that was kind of a cute connection.
Yep.
He didn't expect that. And he was really impressed with, like I said, the gig was a killer gig.
Yep.
Came backstage with a posse and you know, introduced himself. And then we didn't think much of it. We just thought, well, that's good. That's got to be good. Maybe he'll tell people about us.
Yep.
And the next week, we got a call through our management, and he said, we want to put you on the show.
On Countdown.
And we were just like, well, hang on, we haven't even got a record. Like, what do you mean put us on the show?
So of the songs that you wrote, I was discussing this with someone the other day, discussing it with Sue. Most songs, we were actually speaking about Taylor Swift, most songs that people write are about relationships or either breaking up or starting out. How do you go about writing a song, and what did you base your songs on that you wrote?
Yeah, I reckon for me, I went against the grain a bit there. I knew that most songs were kind of lovey-dovey.
Yeah.
And I didn't want them to be lovey-dovey,
no.
Even though I have a song called "A Beat for You" in my heart. But
I remember it, and I love that song.
That's right. So, but generally, I went for a more kind of gothic approach. I wanted the lyrics to sound quite abstract and intriguing and very vague at the best. Mm-hmm. I like them to be full of metaphors, and so it took a lot. And there were so many metaphors in my songs, more than I even knew myself.
Mm-hmm.
So when I read my lyrics that I wrote when I was just 18, 19, 20... sometimes I read more into them now than I think I ever even intended to put in the message.
At the time, and
people would often come up to me and say, oh, that song, you know, Stranger in Me or Destination Unknown.
Destination Unknown.
You know, is that about this or is that about that? And then I'd sort of think about it and go, it's interesting. I don't know what I was singing about there. Yeah, Stranger in Me sounds like I'm some sort of schizophrenic or something. Like it's an unusual lyric, but it dealt with what I was going through.
I hesitate to ask this, Brian, but yep. were any of them? I asked Brett Whiteley when I interviewed. I think I was the last person to interview Brett Whiteley.
Fantastic.
And he had an alchemist. I think he had a series called The Alchemist. And I said, "Did you write any of those on drugs?" He said, "Yep, I was on acid when I painted those pictures."
Oh, I bet.
Did you write any? Were you into substances
squeaky
at all?
Clean
were
when
you?
I was young. Yeah, I'd be lucky if I drank a lemonade and vodka.
So none of the songs were from an outer.
No.
Outer body
experience.
In the
later years.
These days is a different experience because I enjoy a bit of green and,
a little bit of marijuana.
I've done whole albums like that.
Yep.
So I wish I had have known about that back then.
So you had multiple top 20 hits in the 80s.
Yeah.
So this would have set you on the then you went toured overseas and had overseas success.
We did, in a couple of tours of Europe, Japan.
Yeah. Tour of the UK?
Several of the US and the UK, yeah.
And I just from reading this, I think there's been 15 odd members of the band over the years. Is that right?
Probably about right.
I counted them. I looked
I hadn't even counted them.
Well, it said there's 15.
I'll take your word on that. Sounds about right. Maybe more, actually.
Well, were the ones that were listed.
And it said
you disbanded. Why did you disband?
Well, what happened is in 88... we sort of took a turn with our musical direction.
1990, you disbanded, didn't you?
Yeah, pretty much.
That's says
right.
that.
That's right. That sounds about right. Because 88, we delivered an album called Race. And remember this that. Album was a real real departure for Pseudo Echo. It was...
more rock and roll.
It was rock. It was stadium rock, LA rock.
Why did you do that when
because
you sort of...
that's where the trends were going. You know,
because there was a move against synthesizer music, wasn't there?
Well, people,
you got a lot of hard time for it, didn't you?
Well,
for
being a synth there was a move away from it, but also there was a movement of rock fused with electronic music.
That's it.
And that was where you had bands like Bon Jovi and then Van Halen all of a sudden come out with Jump, and it's... predominant instrument is a synthesizer.
Yep.
You got ZZ Top making a comeback and having all this electronic backing, with
they use drum
machines.
It was unheard
of. And so all of a sudden, Run DMC, you've got,
Beastie
with
Aerosmith,
Boys, and stuff like this. And you just go, it's changing. It's moving away from the pop 80s to a kind of a rock 80s. So being based in Australia, we couldn't really stand our ground and just say, we'll stay with this sound because... the trends move, and as the trends move, we had to go. Well, we'll have to
reinvent
jump on this and reinvent.
Yep.
We probably took a step slightly too far, looking back, because we went from a kind of this real new romantic look to all of a sudden long hair and ripped jeans and Marshall
bon
amps
look.
And all this. So it was a bit of a quantum leap, but ironically, over the years, the fans have embraced that again, and it's all good. But let me get back to what happened. So 88, we delivered this album. It wasn't well received at the time. Fans were a bit stunned. The press were kind of not impressed. They just thought they didn't believe it. They said, that's not real. These guys can't rock. But ironically, that's what I grew up with. So it was just a return to my roots, really. So the band did a tour, and it wasn't a great tour. It was a hard tour. We didn't have the numbers that we used to have. And we started to think about calling it a day. We didn't really officially announce anything, but we were sort of saying, I think we've had enough. I think it's time to move on. I wanted to move into production and get behind the scenes rather than being the rock star. And so I was was giving it a good thought.
Was there disharmony?
Because that last album, there was a change in songwriting structure. And I sort of got a bit of a push out from a couple of the newer members.
Yeah.
And then we had a big meeting. A weekly organisation called us in for a big meeting. There were lawyers and record company representatives, and it looked very impressive. And we thought, well, this is it. We're about to get dumped off the label, and that'll be that. And they turned around and said, we've decided to stick by you guys, and we'll invest in a couple more albums. And that was the biggest surprise to me. I absolutely thought it was all over. So that was great. But the next bombshell was two of the guys in the meeting, in the band, turned around and said, oh, actually, we don't want to continue. We're heading off to do our own thing. And so that divided the camp.
Yep.
And right in that meeting, we just had to go, well, what are we going to do? Are we continuing or, mm-hmm. you know, half you guys want to go this way? My mate Pierre was sort of on the fence and he said, oh, I don't know if we should go on without these guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I said, okay, we'll call it a day. That's mm-hmm. that. So that was it, 88, 89, bit of touring, 80, by 90 it was all over.
And when did you reform?
98.
We formed in 97, 98, New Year.
Yep.
So that was a random thing. Some guy was harping at me. And wanted me to play in this retro club, an 80s retro club.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only 10 years
so
after.
So you've been 8 years off the scene and yeah. someone suddenly said, I yeah. tell you what, we
there was already
get
a resurgence
Brian
in the 80s then.
Yeah.
And he called me and said, you've got to put the band back there. And I said, look, half of us not talking to each other. Yeah. And it doesn't matter, as long as I've got you. And yeah. you know, I said, all right, let me call my mate Pierre, see yeah. if he can do it, and I'll grab two other guys. Yeah. He said, no worries. So I had just thought about it. I hadn't really committed to anything. Then he said, okay, calls me up and he goes, got a New Year's Eve gig. The Pointer Sisters are doing it, but they pulled out. And he said, do you guys want to do it?
And I said, where was this?
This was in Sydney, yep. Club Metro.
Mm.
It was a big 80s club.
The Pointer massive. Sisters.
Pointer Sisters yeah. were going to do it. And the 11th hour, they pulled out. Mm-hmm. And he said, you're on. If you want it, it's your gig. It was a good payer too. Mm. Maybe the Pointer Sisters money. it was it was good. So I said, okay, that's kind of convincing.
You're on board.
And
on
what
board.
Songs did you do for
and
that?
We just did the 80s catalogue.
The ones that you
went back
had.
To the early yep. hits and all that. Strung together about, you know, a 15, 20 song set. And I rehearsed the band up pretty mm-hmm. quickly. I spent a lot of time with all the synthesizer sounds because I wanted it to be very convincing. I didn't want it to sound like a half-assed, mm-hmm. you know, trashed together version. Yeah, so
Milli Vanilli version.
That's right. So it was, I did it with a passion.
Yep.
So I had a goal finally. I said, yep. right, this has given me direction to do it. And the night was sensational. It was chockers,
mm.
you know, thousands. I'm talking in
went
a,
over
in a
well.
Club. It was fantastic, and the phones just started ringing.
And the rest is
that.
History. And
beautiful.
Yeah. Your career reignited, yeah, and you started again.
Yeah,
that's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, really good.
You've backed. I get all this information off. You've backed. you've had. You've had scores on movies that
yep.
you've had soundtracks
yep.
of. I see your autumnal...
Autumnal Park.
Yep. Autumnal Park. Autumnal.
Backed...
Who knows how to say it?
Backed Friday the 13th.
Oh, Friday the 13th, yep. yeah. So we had lots of sort of movie placement. You know, the big wigs overseas have these great connections and Wheatley had some good connections and some of these films just... They knew we were this underground band from Australia and they heard some of our material and they said, this is perfect. Mm-hmm. We had this song called His Eyes that was all dark and moody and sort of got a sinister theme throughout. And the Friday 13th franchise grabbed it and said, we want it in the film.
Beautiful.
So
it
was great for us. It was a surf film that put one of our songs in. Revenge of the Nerds wanted to put our song in there. So we started getting lots of songs in film. And that really just, you know, solidified our audience around the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
Often wondered how people who make movies select the soundtracks or what they do. So they're familiar with your work because of your overseas overseas touring and that.
That's right. So they obviously just know the stuff they know and then they put in suggestions. And I think that we probably just fit the mold. We were this kind of, at the time then, we're this sort of new romantic gothic-looking band, and they must have said, this fits the bill.
Is that a fiscally is that a fiscally successful thing to be part of? Do they pay
pay well?
Good money?
It's good. It is good money.
Yeah.
I think it's changed over the years. I think half the time you've got to pay them to be in it now. But in the day, it was good.
Who was your record company back in the day?
Well, we had EMI in Australia and RCA/BMG.
Yep.
For the rest of the world.
Rest of the world.
BMG, really.
RCA
became BMG. And, you know, they were a big, big record label. And we had a fantastic agent in America, the William Morrissey agent.
Oh.
So they were sort of mainly models and kind of actors. But Wheatley had a great contact
in there.
They're
huge in LA, yeah.
Wheatley's best man for his marriage was John Marks, was the CEO. And John was a great fan of the band and travelled on the road with us in the States. And so we got some incredibly good gigs. We were on One Life to Live, you know, the TV series over there. It's a massive soapy.
Nice.
And they had us, you know, on that. They got us on the Joan Rivers show, the Dick Clark show, you know, like they really pulled some strings.
Did you tour with other groups and did you get on well with them or some people you didn't get on well with?
Any war stories?
Sure, an air
of jealousy and rivalry coming from down under, or are some of them?
Look, the international ones were all great. You know, we toured with Culture Club and the Village People in early 2000. Yep.
How did you get along with them?
And that was fantastic. It was really funny. Like, they were all cool guys. They all watch our shows. You know, we toured with Human League. They were fantastic. You know, Phil's a top guy.
Yeah, he's a good buddy. Yeah, did you see him recently? They toured here recently.
Yeah, I missed that show.
They were great, actually.
Yeah. So... you know, all of these bands that we toured with were all fantastic. You know, Simple Minds more recently we did in New Zealand.
Yep.
With what's
Jim Kurt.
What's the other bands? Collective Soul and Texas. They were on the bill too. Yep. They were great. That was a fantastic lineup.
Mm-hmm.
So normally it's great. There's not really any problems. If anything, the problems we had were more with the local bands. Like,
yep.
I think one gig we did, I probably shouldn't mention the band name, but
In Excess?
Some shit 80s band. No longer around.
Yeah.
But they were supporting us on some big, big bloody corporate radio station gig.
Yep.
And it was a big hoo-ha. And they had it all kitted out backstage for us. And they dragged these other dickheads out of the 80s to do this show. And we'd already been touring. We were all already a touring act. So mm-hmm. we were together and it was all going strong. So they did their opening spot.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all great. And then they came backstage and it was all nice. Hey, mate, how are you? All this. Then we went out and did our headline spot. When we came back after we did the gig, we came backstage, the whole band room was trashed. They tipped over the table, thrown the food everywhere.
They did a Led Zeppelin, did they?
They tipped the chairs over, threw things over, monitors ripped off. It was just insane.
And it was wrecked.
Said, what the hell is wrong with these guys? Are they like 15 still? Like, yeah. You know, and so they got black banned and they never got a gig again. But yeah, it was a bit uncool. But because yeah. We nearly looked
you
like
destroyed their career. Us, so yeah, it could have been you. Yeah,
it wasn't us. So yeah, it was. It doesn't happen often.
No.
Well, and so your wife,
Raquel. Yeah.
Raquel. She manages. Manages.
She's the manager.
Handles.
Now?
Handles yeah. All. So how long is this going to go on?
This has happened for about the last 5 years, is that right, darling? Yep.
I didn't mean how long's Raquel been. How long are you, what's your next step? You're just going to keep doing it? Have you got how many?
Absolutely.
Yep.
You've got a gig coming
Raquel
up, haven't you?
Raquel has taken the band from one level up several steps to a major level.
Raquel,
single-handedly, I would say. Incredible. I would give her full brownie points for that. She got me out of the doldrums and perked me up and got me into shape, got me into the gym,
yep.
Got me fixed up.
You're looking well.
Looking shiny.
And you've had a couple of new albums the last 10 years, yeah, 15 years. Tell us about them.
Yeah, we did the After Party album during the COVID crap.
Yep. Yeah. What do you think of all that, mate? Because I know you're a little bit suspicious of some of that stuff.
Well,
Can we go into that? We
shouldn't go there.
We shouldn't go into that? All right.
I'll get cancelled.
You'll get cancelled. All right. Well, we won't talk about that.
But I just spent my time smoking healthy products in the forest.
Fair enough.
Say.
Fair enough.
Made some trippy albums during that time. Which
but
was
that
fun.
Lockdown was a bit crazy, wasn't it?
It was crazy. Yeah.
So you said Raquel had to get you into shape.
Yep.
You'd strayed, had you? You'd got in. What did
oh,
you have to get
I
you into shape over?
I just
into
let
substances
go.
Or
no,
were you
I just
alcohol?
Let go. No,
yep.
No, I was just.
What do you mean you let yourself
let
go, bro?
I was putting on weight and I was looking a bit shabby and dishevelled, and I wasn't really, you know, investing in my style as I had done in the past. So Raquel gave me a good makeover.
Fantastic.
And you know, she was great at pointing me at some big influences, and you know, she said pointed out how Prince had done things over the years, and I started looking at Prince's stuff. I said, yeah, right. I never really got into his material that much, but I can see he's an absolute pro and like
genius,
top of the game. And then she even said, right, we're going to go for a trip overseas and I'm going to take you to Paisley Park, which was Prince's studio and his house.
Yep.
I told my mates I'm going to Prince's joint.
Yep.
And went and had a look there and met his stage... his guitar tech. Guitar tech was fantastic, gave me all his secrets and told me all this stuff. And then they took us into his editing studio and showed us how he would, you know, finish a show and then he'd spend 2 hours critiquing the show and bettering it. And I think I really took a feather from my work ethic.
Yep,
you
know, yep.
And it really...
But he was a workaholic, wasn't he?
He was a workaholic, yep, yeah.
Yep. Well, sad when he died too, because, you know...
Terrible, terrible loss.
And but he was someone who was interested in sort of interesting things. He always, he critiqued chemtrails at one stage. Remember that
yeah,
video
absolutely.
Being online?
Yeah.
And he was a very colourful character.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, these things that Raquel sort of brought to my attention mm-hmm. and took me to see bands that I wouldn't have normally gone to see... Those things helped me immensely because I think I was just caught up in my own world. I never looked back at myself. So from that time, I started watching back our videos. I started looking at it and going, okay, that looks crap. That's no good. Why am I scratching my ass here? I should be talking to the audience. I should be turning my back or, mm-hmm. you know, this guy should be standing there and he should be over this side. And there's all these things that you mm-hmm. you start to build the show back into a proper entertainment. Mm-hmm. And that took us from doing grotty little pubs to hardly anybody to all of a sudden, you know, doing sell-out shows in theatres.
I presume you're a freedom rider and not an activist about... I presume you don't like to be told what you should do with your body or...
That's right.
And the last three or four years have been horrendous for
That's right.
everyone who have put up with it.
That's right.
Most of us... put up with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've got a feeling you didn't put up with it,
no, I didn't.
Brian. A bit like yeah. Novak Djokovic and yeah, a few actually. Others who thought, no, this is nonsense. And
I'm a free thinker, Sam. And,
yes. You're a political person?
Well, you know what? Politics was the least thing that interested me all yeah. my life until the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought lots of books on psychology and read lots about human conditioning and... did my own thinking.
As a result of the pandemic?
Yeah, yeah yep. absolutely. Yeah, I, the things that I was hearing didn't make sense.
And you're being vindicated by the day as things go, yeah. as
and,
life
and
goes
I've
on.
I point out, I'm very alternative. I haven't had a TV set for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't tune into modern media. I have my own thoughts, my own decisions, and I make my own choices. So for me... I don't get any of the slight manipulation and yep. where an agenda can push people around.
Not intimidated to do
no,
things.
Because no, because people are conditioned and they probably don't know yep. they're conditioned, but they are. And it's just something we hear in the airwaves and things like that. So mm-hmm. for me, I didn't get that. So mm. when something's announced, I just see it from the outside and I go, hang on, that sounds a bit odd.
Yeah.
So, you know, look, we, yeah. we all have our opinions and exactly. I respect everybody's opinion. I never want anybody to make an opinion based on what I reckon. Mm. I go, you know what, make your own opinion, make your own choice. But it's
but
good if you can make your own choice.
Particularly exactly. in this country and particularly this state, it was very hard to exist by people who told lies, who
That's
had
right.
no idea what they were talking about. But
yeah.
unless you are a rebel and want to be a... unless you want to be an anarchist and
yeah.
just snub your nose at the law, it was very hard to exist in this state, which forever will
yeah.
be the downfall of the previous government, who were disgraceful.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not asking you to back that up, but that's there. No, but it was. We became world famous for being
yeah.
absolute
yeah.
prudes
yeah,
for no reason.
Yeah.
World's longest lockdown, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that obviously stymied your career.
Yeah,
for
couldn't
like,
tour,
like everyone's,
I
suppose. I
couldn't tour or work
yep.
for a couple of years.
No.
It didn't matter what status my health was at. It just wasn't an option because there were so many restrictions on performing. And, you know, we need a certain amount of people at a show to justify it to cover the cost of the touring. If they're going to say you can only have this many people, we'll say, well, that doesn't work. I'd lose money. So,
mm-hmm.
so who inspires you, or who impressed you, or who would you go and see either in the past, not necessarily living or not living? Who inspired you? What impressed you, and what did you like? Are you an Elvis fan, or you remember Elvis?
Elvis is probably a bit before my day, but
was he?
But I love him.
Yep.
I think he's a
yep.
star. You know, it's hard. When I look at artists, I don't always look at just their music and how I like it personally. I look at what they're achieving.
Yep.
I look at their uniqueness and their craft. And it doesn't matter if I don't like their songs. That's just my personal taste. And everyone has their own thing. Like I said, I wasn't that mad about Prince's stuff. I appreciated it. I liked it later on. George Michael maybe was another
George
one.
George Michael. Yeah.
But Elvis, for sure. I mean, I watched all these docos and I started watching him and thinking, my God, you know, he was a machine, this guy.
Yep.
You know? And there's something to be said for that, you know, being unique, not just being a copier, you know, standing out, taking a risk when everyone else is looking this way or sounding that way, to step out of the crowd. It takes a bit of courage and a bit of, you know, bit of a risk taker, and you've got to give it your all.
Mm-hmm. You've got to admire that.
Mm. It must be, like, I couldn't name one song that she sings and I didn't go and see her, but the phenomena of Taylor Swift is extraordinary.
Did you see Taylor Swift?
I did not see Taylor Swift.
No, and you wouldn't. I didn't necessarily.
It's hard not to see her, but we know of her.
I've heard of her too. What do you think of the phenomena?
I think that's just a big corporate machine. It's you know, that's what all those A-list artists are.
Yeah.
It's a machine. You know, there's a button to be pressed, and when it's pressed, everything operates, and that's how it goes. You know, you got a corporation that'll have a finger in every pie. I'm not trying to take anything away from these artists because they have to be very talented to be in that position.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, these corporations, they have a lot of power and a lot of influence from the amount of streaming, the amount of exposure, you know, everything to do with an artist.
What artists the last 20 years have...
Of your peers in, say, Australia, who do you gravitate to? Who do you admire?
You know, I really admired Kevin Parker from Tame Impala. Tame Impala? Not the car, the band.
Did you ever come across Michael Hutchins in excess?
I met Michael a couple of times.
Did you get along with him? Was he a bit rude?
What Michael said to me was, one year I took out Australia's most popular male performer. That was about 1986 or seven, one of those.
So he would have been in the running
Michael
as well.
Michael used to take that out every year. I think he took it out 5 years in a row. It was Barnes, he'd be in there, Farney would be in there, and, you know, they'd all be in there, the big league.
Yep.
And one year I was nominated.
Yep.
And I was impressed that I was nominated. I didn't expect I'd be in the running, but I thought, oh, that sounds pretty good. And
1 year you won.
And I took it out that year. I was stoked. I just went, wow. So anyway, at the after party, a couple of journalists, you know, saw Michael standing there and me standing here, and they said, hey, I've got to get a photo of you two, you know, the winner and the... I don't know if he said the loser.
And the runner-up.
But he just said the winner and the... I can't remember. I just tuned out after that. I thought, oh, Jesus. And, you know, his Hutch looking as cool as cool. Yeah. And Michael sort of, you know... I knew the other guys in the band. Yeah. I just didn't know Michael.
Yeah.
So Michael came over and shook my hand and they took some photos. And,
that was nice.
And he leaned over and he said, you know that award? I said, yeah. He goes, it's yours. Take it. Because I think it was a stigma to him.
Yeah.
I think he just...
He was happy not to win it.
I think he was happy not
to win it. So you were nominated for a lot of awards and you won a number of them.
Yeah.
So... To be recognised by, I don't know, your peers, I suppose, is the most important thing. We had a discussion about the media, about football earlier on, about just on what basis do people become hypocrites and try and placate their bosses and become sycophants. But if you're recognised by your peers, that is good. So
that's good, yeah.
It's been a fantastic career for you.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, it's one of the biggest things that means to you. I mean... To have respect from your peers is definitely a good goal.
And do you have more song? Do you working on writing any more?
Yeah,
material.
I've got a.
How do you do that? You sit down and
I have my studio in the middle of the house in the forest there, so it's a good inspiration. Mm-hmm. We're mid tour. We're doing a machine tour, which we took from the original name, so that machine.
Yep.
So that's an interesting tour because. Previously, we did a big concert run in theatres. This one, we brought it back to the clubs so they can all dance. And
you've got complaining. You've got a concert in Melbourne next week?
We've got Billboard, 170 Russell.
What day is that?
That's the May 24.
May 24.
May 24. Get along. That's going to be
Billboard.
Billboard. 170 Russell, they call it these days. So it's a great gig. It's all cascaded. It's
and are you doing that just you?
No, it's Pseudo Echo.
It's just no one else.
There will be an opening act, but I don't know what it is.
You've got a supporting act.
There is a support act. Yeah. So there's that happening. There's I'm making a new remix album where I've already done one with the listening track, our first single.
Yeah.
So that was like an anniversary.
Is that the 40th anniversary single? It is. Yeah. Yeah. I love that track, by the way. That first track was just fantastic.
Yeah. So we did that remix, and that's been really well received with the fans. Which is it's a fine line with remixing. I'm not a big fan of letting anyone touch my stuff because I feel I took my name on it, my voice on it, my brand, but it's sometimes not anything to do with what I am. Yeah, it's somebody else's work just with my voice. So I feel a little bit disconnected sometimes from remixes. So I chose to do these myself, which is challenging because it's kind of a young person's game. So you've got to really educate yourself and open your ears up and have a listen. But then again, I also don't like following. I don't like jumping on the trend that everyone else is doing. Sometimes I'm so out of fashion that it's in fashion.
So you get up in the foothills, light up a construct a big banger, light it up, chill back, and just see what comes up, and put it down on paper and go to Billboard and play it.
That's right. You've got to be cautious about the operating of software.
Machine. You know, that's right.
You push the
don't operate any heavy machinery.
Push the erase button in the wrong spot.
That's right, like we do here sometimes.
Yeah. You've got to have your shit together.
So you got a new pseudo album on the way, you think?
Well, the remix album, and then probably next year. Well, next year we're going to do the celebration of the Love and Adventure album.
Oh, great.
So that's the 40th anniversary.
Well, that's a great album. We
got a few things already in the pipeline for the next couple
I remember
of years.
Buying that at Doncaster Shopping Town in 1984. Yeah, How's that when I would have been 14?
And you'll like this, Richard. I don't know if you know already, but I did a little bit of acting.
Yes, you did.
A little tiny bit.
He had a part in my film, The Beautiful and Damned.
I did it. Richard got me started. But of lately, the guys from Regurgitator, Quine in particular, asked me to be in their video clip of their latest song, Cocaine Runaway.
Oh,
they said, you need to be a cocaine addict and you're driving a Lamborghini. And I said, oh, I'm pretty sure I know a few of those. So I'll just go and have a little look and take some notes. And away we went. And he did say to me, look, how do you feel about wearing a wig?
Yeah.
I said, what are you trying to say? And so I said, oh, let's have a look at the wig. And it was like a Don Johnson wig. So I said, oh, I'm all right with that. Some pastel gear, you know, pastel suit.
Bit of a Miami Vice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I had the whole thing going on.
Well, Brian, if you're after props, I can't supply you with the cocaine, but if you step through that door,
well,
I can give you a Lamborghini.
Yeah, that's great.
I was just going to say. So, who's marketing the Billboard gig? How do people, or is it sold out? Or?
It's in house. Raquel and her posse. They get out there and
how do you get tickets?
Well, tickets are online. You can go to pseudoecho.net. It's just one word.
Pseudoecho.net.
They're all the links are there, or you can just go straight to one.
Ticketek,
Oztix, all of those things.
Well, we had Mike Brady in a couple of weeks ago, and we mentioned his gig. He texted me this morning, and he said he did it yesterday. Thursday, he said it was sold out, and he thanked us. He thought we might have
contributed.
We might have contributed, so we hope you can. We wouldn't have to contribute to yours. I'm sure it will be a success enough. But we really appreciate you coming in, Brian Kenham, and Rachel. Thank you very much for coming in. And always a good idea if you're going to introduce people is get their names spelt and pronounced correctly. About that, Raquel. So it's been fantastic for you to come in. I really appreciate it, and we wish you well. And we might sneak into Billboard.
Come on down.
A couple of names on the door. What do you reckon, Raquel?
No, we don't want any names on the door. We're not into that. We'll buy a ticket if we go. That's
fair
what
enough.
We don't want any names on the door. That's his business. So we don't want to encroach on his business.
All right.
We'll pay. So thank you very much for coming in, Raquel, and Brian Canham from Pseudo Echo. Thank you so
Cheers,
much.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Great stuff.